thanks for doing this, Toby. I really appreciate you taking the time and having a quick chat with me this morning. So tell me a little bit about your book and where did the idea for the book come from and why you embarked on that journey?
Sure. It's really a book about humanity, our 200,000-year past and our future that may be millions of years long, and the potential that we have in humanity's future, yet how it's all at risk at the moment, that we've, with the development of nuclear weapons, entered this unique period of risk in humanity's long past. And this is a time that I call the precipice. I think that ultimately it can't go on for more than a couple of centuries, because ultimately I think that the risk is escalating at such a rate that we couldn't make it for more than that long. For one way or another, either we'll get our act together and bring these risks down and stop threatening our future, or we'll end up succumbing to them if we can't do that. So this is based around the idea of existential risk, so which is risks either of human extinction or of the permanent collapse of civilization. Either way, it's the irrevocable loss of almost all that humanity could achieve, which sounds a bit like a gloomy topic, but it's one that I've been drawn to by being so inspired about what we could achieve if we survive and try to ensure that we do. And these are things that I've been discussing for a long time here at Oxford University, particularly with my colleague, Nick Bostrom, who developed some of these ideas.
So when you talk about extinction and, you know, civilization defining issues, can you give me a little bit more understanding of that? Are you talking about, you know, nuclear technology? Are you talking about other technologies, or is it a combination of all those things?
Yeah. So I think that humanity, like other species, has been at some risk of extinction for our entire lifespan. But we know that for all the natural risks put together, the asteroids, the supervolcanoes, comets, other types of things that have been around for all that time, we know that they can't be posing all that much risk per century. After all, we've just gone through 2,000 centuries without succumbing to such a risk. And we know that species like us typically survive for something like a million years. So the risk in any one century from these natural things can't be that high. But last century, we saw humanity's long ascent in power, this kind of exponential trends towards increasing power over the world, finally reach a point where we developed nuclear weapons and we first had the power, so much power that we could destroy our entire future. And then when it came to our carbon emissions, this is another thing where these have exponentially increased to the point where, again, we might be able to threaten our entire future. So these are two current existential risks. Maybe we could cause our own extinction or some kind of permanent collapse from which we can never come back. And I think that there are even larger risks on the horizon, risks from genetically engineered pandemics that we might create, and also perhaps from unaligned artificial intelligence. So these are things that aren't quite possible yet, but I think will be bigger risks over the next 100 years than the ones that we currently have.
I mean, that's also assuming a very pessimistic viewpoint on human capability and human civilization. I mean, all the things which you define as risks also have the capability of providing a way forward from all, any kind of negative situations. Like, look at human life, how long we live anymore. Live these days, we can come back from, you know, fatal diseases, almost fatal diseases of yesterday, and, you know, live longer. We have managed to harness nuclear power for energy and for other sources. The same fossil fuels, which are a problem, have also fueled last 100 years of human growth. So, you know, there is always the upside and that downside to all kind of development. I mean, why take such a pessimistic view of the of the future.
Oh, I don't know that I am taking a pessimistic view of the future. I agree with you that for nuclear power has been very useful. Obviously, the advances that we've had since the Industrial Revolution, which were fueled by these fossil fuels, have indeed seen the quality of life go up substantially, really massively, actually, over the last 200 years. And I agree that biotechnology and artificial intelligence have great promise for the future as well. So we agree that, I mean, they're not just mild upsides on these technologies. They're very large upsides. So I'm not trying really to weigh the upsides against the downsides. I'm not saying we shouldn't have technologies like this or something like that. I'm saying that there are downsides, and that these downsides have a particular unique quality that many of the other ones don't. So when it comes to smaller risks, say risks of individual loss of life with new technologies, we have a historical record that shows that for all of those types of risks, lifespan and health have increased despite all of those. And so we actually know that on this kind of day-to-day level, the upsides have outweighed the downsides of a lot of these technologies, certainly overall. But there are these new risks which could put an end to our 2,000 centuries of human development and could cut off the thousands of centuries in the future. And they're of a particular unique type where humanity often muddles through. You know, we learn from trial and error. Things go wrong. We have some period of very bad pollution in our cities, and then we kind of learn that that's not worth it, and we work to clean it up and make sure we pollute less in these ways. But when it comes to these risks, we don't get any second chances. They're basically defined as things that would be the permanent loss of all value in the future. For example, there's no way back from extinction. So if we want to have a long and flourishing future, we need to get through another 2,000 centuries without ever once doing one of these things. And so that requires special care and attention to make sure that we succeed there.
So just to understand this, you're saying that all the new technologies have accelerated the time frame with which, you know, we as a race have to, or as creatures have had to deal with all these outsized events. In the past, the scale of time was more manageable, more biological, but now we have artificially added technologies which may increase the scale of failure and issues might get out of hand. Is that a fair assessment on my end?
Yeah, that's right. It's more, one way to think about it is how big could one mistake be? So it's partly that, you know, one of the underlying things is the increasingly rapid rates of change, but more so is the size of the effects. The fact that one nation making serious mistakes, or even just the, you know, very small group of leaders in one nation could trigger a global nuclear war. So you've got this situation where a certain kind of relatively small mistake could then lead to these massive repercussions all over the world, and not just all over the world affecting the 7 billion people alive today, but perhaps cutting off the trillions of lives that could have been led if we didn't fall victim to this.
I'm guessing that there is a precedent for that. We had the World War I, there was one small mistake which led to many multiple mistakes and to a large-scale conflict after that.
Yeah, that's a good example of a mistake leading to something at the scale of tens of millions of deaths. Whereas what we're trying to do here is to make it so that we never make a mistake that could lead to all the deaths.
It's pretty ironic you bring this up. You know, we're seeing this play out in the real time over the near pandemic situation around coronavirus. And like how it's spreading across the world. I wonder what you think about that.
I'm certainly watching it with great interest as well. I worry that it will become a global pandemic. I think that looks likely, and that it could cause a large amount of loss of life and also make a lot of people ill. It looks quite unlikely that it would be the biggest pandemic we've ever seen. We have had very, very big and very lethal ones in the past. So that does give us some warning. For example, the 1918 flu, it killed about 1 in 30 people across the entire world's population. And the Black Death in Europe killed between a quarter and half of all people in Europe, which is about a tenth of all the people in the world. So we have seen situations where disease has caused these very severe death tolls. Although in some ways it was encouraging that when it came to the Black Death, that this didn't cause any kind of collapse of civilization in Europe. And the 1918 flu didn't either. So I hope that when it comes to these natural types of pandemics, that it's actually really quite hard for them to really rise to this level of existential risks. And that when it comes to pandemics, I'm much more worried about engineered ones when scientists enhance the natural capabilities of pandemics. That's the kind of thing that gives me much more cause for concern at this level.
I mean, I think, again, a very valid point that, but like, look at the world we live in right now. I think 1918, the world was much less connected than it is today. Like, you know, I mean, just looking at the flight patterns on flight radar every day, you can see how much is, like, how extreme is the movement of people around the planet. And so, you know, a small mistake can be easily distributed at a global scale. And I wonder if we, you know, thinking about the genetically engineered problems is perhaps thinking too far when we might actually have near-term issues, you know, which may seem more trivial, but like they're medicized because we are so deeply networked now.
Oh, yes. It could indeed get almost all over the world. And actually, the 1918 flu did. It was found almost everywhere. I think there were some islands in the Pacific that didn't get it, but it got to all the inhabited continents. So that was something that really did infect a lot of people. And one thing that's helpful here is that the case fatality rate of this novel coronavirus looks to be lower than that of the 1918 flu. And to be below about 2%, such that even if everyone in the world did get it, then hopefully only 1 in 50 of us would die, and that this wouldn't cause the kinds of final failures for humanity, which are the type of thing that I think is so important to guard against.
Right. I think the other positive or encouraging aspect of the change has been how quickly researchers around the world have managed to collaborate and come up with some solutions as well. I think, you know, this is like a good example of technology working in favor of humanity. At, you know, just when you also think the network creates more panic and chaos in the society at the same time. So it's like a really good case study of like the good and bad of tech.
Yeah, it's a good example of global cooperation.
But like, you know, I was thinking about your comments. I think, you know, the biggest challenge we might have, especially considering today's, you know, very polarized, you know, political climate, that we as humans start to stop collaborating and start to think about each other in a more tribal terms, and which may lead to much more issues than exist today. And, you know, do you think that's some of the things you wonder if we should be, you know, working actively against? I mean, it seems like that may be the number one cause of, like, any kind of global issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. So sometimes when people look at these risks, there's only a small amount of interest in academia in these risks at these larger scales. And even among the people who are interested in preventing these risks and making sure that we safeguard our future, there's people often focus on things that are themselves risks. So, for example, asteroids or the risk of nuclear war, whereas some other things that exacerbate these issues but aren't themselves existential risks. For example, just war between great powers such as Russia and the US. It's not that them having a war at all is itself a risk of human extinction directly, but it clearly increases the risk. And so I think of things like this, I call them existential risk factors. And it seems that there are quite a few of these that you could talk about. Or you could also talk about the opposite, existential security factors, things that that lower risk if they're had. And I think that that's a really useful way to look at it and to try to understand. And I think that global cooperation of various sorts is one of these security factors, or equivalently, factionization, tribalism, and so forth is a risk factor.
So won't it be like a lot of these small risks become like a big problem for us? I mean, we tend to focus on the big problem, but you look at if there are multiple small wars in different parts of the world over the next 100 years, they lead to much more problems. Let's say even if smaller nuclear weapons are used, or even, smaller chemical weapons are used, the compounding effect of many such conflicts can be huge. And, what if we have like 200 coronavirus-like pandemics over the next 200 years, next 100 years? Just the cumulative issues of that are probably more of a risk than any big bang, a problem we might experience and the entire, human race is wiped out.
Yeah, I'm not sure. One thing is that if you look at the particular risks, so the things that are themselves risks to humanity's entire future, such as being hit by an asteroid, there are a lot of such risks if people have tried to catalog them and kind of list them. And one thing that I try to do in my book is to stress how small some of them are compared to others. Ultimately, all of the natural risks that we face put together, if you add them all up, they ultimately come to something about 0.1% over the next century, something like that. So we're talking there, something that's pretty small. Whereas if we look at the anthropogenic risks that we already have, I'd put that at about, at least 10 times as likely as the natural risks. And then I think that the future risks might be 10 times as likely again. So I think that you really get this escalation of risk over time, and that they're often of very different sizes to each other. Although, you kind of have to take my word on that. You can look at some of these numbers, but it is very difficult to come up with these final estimates, and I could well be wrong. But when it comes to, I think maybe what you were getting at more was that there's a whole lot of these events that kind of add stresses to the situation we're in. So smaller conflicts, which aren't themselves any kind of existential risk, but which make the geopolitical situation more fraught. And if you kind of increase the tempo and amount of these things, then maybe they just, lead to higher chances of great power war and people using whatever weapons they have available and things like that, that then could themselves be existential risks.
What do you make of the emergence of global networks of communication, whether it's Facebook, Twitter? Do you think those have added to risk to us as a civilization?
I'm not sure that they've changed it, the risk levels appreciably. I would have hoped initially. So if you asked me this question before we'd really started them, if it was the very early years of Twitter and Facebook, I would have been more hopeful that they would actually lower the risk by helping people understand one another more, letting the people of each country, instead of the leaders, have direct communication and make friendships across the world. And then it's much harder to dehumanize someone and think of them as the enemy. Unfortunately, the actuality of these networks seems to have gone the other way in terms of how it's kind of created a lot of animosity, more than I think a lot of goodwill towards other people. And then obviously there's use of them by leaders kind of sidestepping other channels of communication and so on in favor of these more direct and immediate channels. I'm not sure overall, but it's not looking as good as I would have hoped.
You know, I was looking at some of my own work from 2010 and kind of look back and just say, wow, somewhat naive in my optimism around some of the technologies, because, you know, as an optimist, you tend to forget that, you know, there's people have a base instinct, and that's essentially sometimes dominates, you know, some of our better instincts. So I think that's the network has started to amplify the negativity a little bit too much. And that I find is one of the current risks to us as people more than anything else. If we lose optimism, you know, we can't invent a better future. That's how I feel about it.
I agree. And I found that my colleagues working on these issues of the risks, the biggest risks facing humanity, are by and large all optimists. We're a group of people who have been so impressed by what's been able to be achieved in the past, how far we've come as humanity, and how far we might go in the future. The last chapter of The Precipice, I leave risks aside and just look at the future that we might be able to have, trying to think, not so much to predict a particular path, but to look at, you know, what are the upper bounds to what we might be able to achieve? What, you know, how long could we last? How far might we go? Could we spread throughout the galaxy or beyond? And could we change the quality of our lives? Could we get rid of the pain and suffering in our lives? And could we have much greater peaks and heights of experience? And trying to really think through the broad outlines of what we might be able to achieve, the canvas on which we would paint our future. And that's something that does inspire me a lot. And this was something that science fiction used to deal with much more. And then there was this turn during the 20th century towards more dystopian and pessimistic science fiction. And there hasn't been... I'm still waiting for the tide to go out on that and for a more optimistic view, because it's much more instructive to tell people, here are some really good visions for what we could create, rather than just, here are a few terrible things to avoid. I think you get more information content by pointing towards the good things than just by pointing out the bad things.
You know, it's very strange you bring up the more optimistic, need for a more optimistic narrative. I mean, I've been writing about that in recent times. But again, our conversation, we started off talking about, you know, my mind went towards, wait, you know, things are going to be pretty bad. We can be extinct. And like, you know, as human beings, we are so predisposed to actually thinking about what could go wrong rather than what could go right. And I think that is just like so instructive at times. I'm not sure if I have a better answer to that, but I think, you know, we tend to go a little bit more negative pretty quickly. I mean, and so anyway, I don't even know why I asked that question. I just an observation.
Well, yeah, and it's somewhat surprising then that these biggest risks are so neglected. That there is a lot of conversation about, say, at the moment, about climate change, and in the past there was a lot of conversation about nuclear war. Which is still a big threat despite the Cold War ending. And so these are topics that get a lot of interest, and yet they end up still very neglected. And one of the things I point out in the book is that humanity ultimately is spending less on safeguarding its future than it spends on ice cream, just to put it into some kind of perspective. Another thing is that I find useful is if you think of this a perspective of humanity. So trying to think not just of what should I do, or what should my community or nation do, or even what should everyone alive at the moment do. But if you think about everyone who's ever lived and everyone who ever will live, and humanity over this vast span of time, and if you think of it in terms of a life, because to some extent we're acting like a group agent and we have our own, you know, desires and hopes and plans over that time, that ultimately, humanity is in its adolescence at the moment. If we're 200,000 years old, a typical species lasts a million years, and we're kind of risking it all just for, you know, for this tiny moment in one day of our life. with almost no regard or thinking, you know, the amount of time a typical person spends thinking about anything beyond the next 5 or 10 years is almost nothing. It just seems like this is one way of diagnosing what's going wrong here and why it is that we're spending so little on safeguarding our future.
How do you make people think about the long term, you know, when everybody's so focused on near term and also self-interest more than anything else? I think that I often wonder about.
Well, one thing I've done is to try to really look at the past of humanity. And this is something that I found very inspiring the more that I looked into it, on how many generations we've had. There's this lovely thought by Edmund Burke on society as this partnership of generations, that almost everything that we have, if you look around you, certainly if I look around me in my office here, there's nothing that I can see, and maybe apart from my own body, which was part of the natural world. Everything, and if you look at a particular object, such as the torch kind of next to me or something, let alone my phone, that every single aspect of it had to rely on innovations spanning back a huge amount of time. We often think, you know, if we're really zooming out, we think of, say, the last 5,000 years, because that's the time of written history. And we think of, you know, the great things humanity's done in that time. But even that is only about 2% of the lifespan of humanity. And many of the greatest things we've done, such as constructing our languages and things, were done before that. Some of the greatest explorations, the first humans to set foot in Australia and to see this new world of marsupials and strange new creatures and things and new ecosystems and to name all these animals and to understand how they fit together and what they do. And these people are all, you know, our ancestors who we will never know their names. But what they did has kind of been passed down through time to us. And we're just... So I think of it as it's like standing on the shoulders of giants, but that we, you know, if we've seen further than others, it's because we're standing on the shoulders of the 100 billion people who came before us and built this world and everything in it through this long-standing partnership of the generations. And when I think of it that way, and then I think about the prospect that it could be our generation that's the one that drops the baton, you know, and fails all of these thousands of generations before, and we're the one who you know, where there are no more generations to follow, you know, that would be absolutely terrible thing. You know, we would be the worst generation who ever lived if that's what we did. Whereas alternatively, if we see that we're now at this new heightened period of risk, and what we do is we change this situation, and we try to rise to the challenge and build the institutions and norms that guarantee that we get through this this period of extra risk, and that we lower the risks and make sure they're never substantial again, then we may be one of the greatest generations who have ever lived. And so I think a lot of that, it's not that I'm painting some vision of doom or depression. I think it could well be that this is a time that will be remembered for us coming into our maturity and actually thinking of the future and safeguarding it. I really hope that we do.
It's a good time for us to, you know, good way to end this conversation as well, because I think we need that optimism. Before I go, what are the most surprising things you heard, learned during the research for your book right now?
Yeah, I would say the most surprising thing, one of the risks I'm most concerned about is this risk of engineered pandemics, particularly through the risk of biological warfare. And when you look into this, you hear a lot of people who say, well, we don't need to worry so much about that because we're protected by the Biological Weapons Convention. Which is, you know, a sister convention to the Chemical Weapons Convention and the main anti-nuclear treaties. But when I looked into this, I found that the entire Biological Weapons Convention, the amount of funding it has per year is less than that of a typical McDonald's. So this is a case where we could do so much more to actually safeguard our future. I think there is a lot of room for improvement here. It's not the case that there's some people who are trying really hard and they've got it almost all sorted out and they're doing the best they can. I think this is a case where, you know, we once we start taking these things seriously, we can do so much better.
Well, great. This has been awesome talking to you. I wish, you know, we could do this for a much longer period of time and we could do it in real life and not over the internet. But hopefully I will have an opportunity to meet with you in the near future. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
And I look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you.